Hi, it's Amy. Before we get started, I've got a little disclaimer. You might be wondering why we've got a new episode out today and why we didn't have one last week. Well, the piece that you're about to hear is something we've been working on for a couple of weeks. It was supposed to go out last week, but just as we were getting ready to publish it, our reporters uncovered new details. The story kept moving, so we held off on publishing anything, and now it's ready. So thank you for bearing with us, and hope you enjoy. All right, here it is. A couple of weeks ago, I called up the FT's Paris correspondent, David Keohane. He was just getting back to the FT Bureau. David, can you tell us what you've been up to today?
I'm just back from the Renault annual general meeting, which is the big shareholder meeting and the first one since Carlos Ghosn was arrested last November, as everybody knows, ex-boss of Renault, ex-boss of the Renault-Nissan alliance. It was also the first shareholder meeting where Jean-Dominique Senard, the new Renault chairman, is this kind of like, you know, elegant, tall, very diplomatic establishment Frenchman who was parachuted in by the government to take over after Ghosn's arrest. Well, he was took over in January. Well, he had to address shareholders for the first time.
Bien, mesdames et messieurs, chers actionnaires.
And he was doing it again. It gets more complicated. He was doing it a little over, it was about 2 weeks now, a week and a half, when the first the merger with FCA was proposed with Fiat Chrysler, and then it collapsed. So, eventful time for Monsieur Senard.
This is Behind the Money with the Financial Times. I'm Amy Keane. On this episode, we're looking at the mooted merger between Italy's Fiat Chrysler and France's Renault. How the deal came together, how it fell apart, what Renault's alliance partner Nissan made of it, and what it all means for the future of global car manufacturing. So what can you tell us about Carlos Ghosn?
I can do my best. So Carlos Ghosn is this like larger than life chief executive. He was always known as being a little brash, a little outspoken, but he was also one of the most respected executives in the world, particularly in the auto industry. He held together the Renault-Nissan alliance. He was kind of its architect, so to speak. To do that, you have to be culturally adroit. You have to be able to navigate kind of the French and Japanese establishment. You have to push off the French government. You have to push back the Japanese government, who they're not shareholders, but obviously when it's a car company, you always have to take into account national interests. It's just the nature of it. You should always assume that they fly the country's flag. It's the way it is.
What was the point of this alliance? Why was it set up?
Well, it was for scale, essentially. Nissan was in trouble. Renault took a stake. And they have been trying to bring their two companies closer together in order to, well, to eke out synergies. But that's dry. But it's to build cars on the same platforms, to get cost savings in terms of purchasing. So it was kind of an example in the car industry where mergers are notoriously difficult of a kind of non-merger that was beneficial to both sides. But the problem was it was almost a stasis, and no one knew what would happen once Carlos Ghosn left. That was the crux of the matter. So the idea was that he was to make it irreversible before he left. And from there, we get into a whole other narrative.
Breaking news. In the past few minutes, Nissan has revealed that its chairman has been arrested after allegations of serious misconduct.
The carmaker's chairman is thought to have failed to declare compensation truthfully.
He's the CEO of Renault, the chairman of Nissan, the chairman of Mitsubishi, and then the leader of the whole alliance. Who speaks for the alliance now that Carlos Ghosn's been arrested?
Leo, do you remember where you were or what you were doing when you first heard that Carlos Ghosn had been arrested?
Yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary thing.
Leo Lewis is Tokyo correspondent for the FT.
You know, I don't know how far this sort of filtered into the outside world's understanding of the situation, but a single Japanese media organization knew that the arrest was coming and had positioned people, you know, on the apron of the runway for this airplane. And so one gets this information through, well, hang on, the Asahi is saying that Ghosn's been arrested. And first of all, there's a slight disbelief, and you think, hang on, does it... going. They've got the right guy, you know, sort of thing. And within moments, you know, we had the TV on in the office, and we were watching it all unfold, because it was very much sort of the sort of early evening, really, here. You know, everyone's in the office. That's the sort of time of the day where London's, you're waking up, and we're having our first calls into London and so on. And so we're all there and waiting. And then it just sort of spiraled into this extraordinary night where Saikawa called a press conference.
Hiroto Saikawa, he's Nissan's chief executive officer.
But Nissan's headquarters is not in Tokyo. Nissan's headquarters is in Yokohama, which is not far away, but it's a train journey, and you have to go out of town, out of central Tokyo, and on a train, and then get to Nissan's headquarters, which we did. And so the entire press corps of you know, is on their way suddenly out to Yokohama for this extraordinary press conference, which, you know, in all the years covering Japan, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. It's really difficult to understate just what a big deal Carlos Ghosn was in Japan. And so his arrest was a matter of absolute fascination. The allegations that nobody quite initially understood, and what had he been doing, and so understating his pay, and what does that mean? And
we should note that Mr. Ghosn denies these allegations.
You know, there's this whole kind of confusion that you know, in some ways has still not been resolved, you know. So yes, I remember every beat of it. And in the wake of that arrest, we have learned a great deal more about the tensions that existed between Renault and Nissan, many of which he was able to sort of paper over and some of which he was not. So in 2015, there'd been a kind of renegotiation of the alliance, and that had got pretty fractious. And then obviously in the months since his arrest, we've really seen the relationship between Nissan and Renault fraying quite severely. And then, you know, you had sort of Fiat Chrysler and a few other players out on the periphery as possibles, I suppose you'd say, as people that might at some point enter talks with one or another of the players in the alliance. And lo and behold, what they did was, behind the scenes, begin talks with Renault.
Fiat Chrysler. The carmaker is partly owned by Italy's billionaire Agnelli dynasty. The family also owns Ferrari, the soccer club Juventus. They own The Economist, and they even own a Bermuda reinsurer. But it's Fiat Chrysler, or FCA as it's often called, that is its biggest investment. And the fourth generation heir to this fortune, well, that's FCA's chairman, John Elkann. Rachel, why was John Elkann interested in Renault in the first place?
In the first place, it's important to keep in mind that John Elkann is not just chairman of FCA. He's the largest shareholder of FCA.
Rachel Sanderson is the FT's Milan correspondent.
This is an important distinction that John Elkann has skin in the game. John's aim, as he said multiple times, is to preserve the family investment that he inherited, or better still, to improve that investment, i.e. to make the family wealthier. And so we come to the interest in Renault. John and his former chief executive, Sergio Marchionne, who was an Italian-Canadian, long argued that the auto industry suffers from overcapacity and technological disruption, or the risk from technological disruption. So John and Sergio Marchionne had already done one merger, rescuing a nearly bankrupt Fiat by merging it into US Chrysler. But since then, they've also argued they needed to do another big merger to create a group that in total was producing 6 million to 7 million cars a year. And that was in order to make their global automaker viable, given the difficulties, the stormy environment they're in. And ultimately, you have to remember to preserve the Agnelli family fortune. And this is what brings us to Renault. So John has admitted he's been talking to automakers around the world for years about a possible deal. And suddenly he sees an opportunity opening up with Renault, in part because of the tensions happening elsewhere in Renault's orbit with Nissan.
We are following a major developing story in the auto world this morning.
Fiat Chrysler FCA has submitted a proposal for a transformative merger with Renault.
It would be a 50-50 merger, the management structure to be determined.
So, David, was this meant to be a kind of merger of equals?
They did not want to use that phrase. But, you know, it was 50-50 with FCA, which paying a special dividend to kind of equalize the valuation of the two companies. One of the criticisms of this merger proposal is that it, well, some bankers have said this to me, so it's that it was presented without being complete. There was no leadership decided, there was no leadership announced, and the valuation was still open for discussion. Once you do that and you kind of start the discussion after kind of making the proposal public, that gives all the vested interests time to shout, to say, I don't want this. This is not how it should be. And I know, you know, that the French state wasn't happy with the valuation, that they thought it wasn't reflective of Renault's value.
A key piece of this story is the role of the French government. David told me that it was the French state that had actually directed Carlos Ghosn to go and make the partnership with Nissan irreversible.
So the French state said, okay, we're good with this deal. We'd like it to go ahead, but we have conditions. Those conditions were jobs, always jobs. So, you know, the idea that Renault would lose jobs, that's just not tenable, particularly with the current political environment in France. So they said, no jobs lost, no factories to close. Fine. They said, we do not want this to weaken the alliance in any way. Okay, the Renault-Nissan alliance. And there was another one that was, it was to do with the new group would have to support European batteries, but we can put that aside. That's not super relevant. The fourth one, which became the biggest, was that they wanted Nissan to explicitly support the deal. They wanted to be sure that Nissan supported the deal.
But the issue is that Nissan likely only found out about these merger talks when the news broke publicly.
As far as we understand it, for the overwhelming majority of people at Nissan, including the very senior executives, it seems to have been absolutely the first that they'd heard of it as well. A formal notice of the merger talks was delivered a day afterwards, or a day and a half afterwards, and really does seem to have been a serious source of irritation for Nissan that they were not brought in sooner. So the talks had clearly been going on for several months. Between Fiat and Renault. And so, you know, after all that talk about, you know, management by consensus and, you know, running the alliance by consensus, you know, here you had a situation where Renault appeared to have made a decision that it was sort of telling its alliance partner about as a fait accompli. And, you know, actually, I think in the end, Nissan actually handled it probably fairly well. I mean, they didn't kick up a great fuss, but they said that you know, they needed time to understand more about the you know, the merger proposal that was on the table, and things were at that point moving very, very quickly. And I think as a general observation of Japanese companies, they felt they needed time, and they didn't get it, so you know, that was yet another source of friction.
The narrative is that basically the French thought that Nissan supported the deal. And then when it came to the board meeting, the final board meeting where all of this came undone, the two Nissan board members said they would abstain. Now, if you're not talking to the state, you're talking to other people, you know, in journalistic lingo, familiar with the matter, they will say that the Nissan board members abstained positively. They abstained because Nissan wanted more time to analyze this. And so there was this moment where Nissan abstained. The French state's board representative went and talked to the finance minister. There was a delay of about an hour, and the board meeting had already dragged on for 5 hours at this stage. I can tell you because I was writing about it and it was late. And he came back and he basically said, the state's board representative, Martin Vial, said, look, this isn't going to, we need a delay. We need a delay of 5 days for the finance minister, Bruno Le Maire. He's going to be in Japan anyway because of the G20 finance minister's meeting. He wants to go and talk to his Japanese counterparts. He wants to see them face to face, and he wants to be assured of their support. At that stage, Misha Senar, he called John Elkann at FCA, and he said, look, there's going to be a delay. Sorry, it's going to be a delay. And he's sorry, before doing that, he had actually warned everyone that if there is a delay, we could kill this deal. So he called Elkann. A little while later, he gets a text from Elkann saying, it's off.
Rachel, what was going through John Elkann's mind during all of this?
This was his family investment on the line, one that he'd been charged with preserving. A person close to him said to me he did not want to see the stock price of his company just hanging for 5 days in the market while the French state prevaricated. John felt he'd done a lot of due diligence building up to the offer FCA made to Renault as well. He went to see Emmanuel Macron, France's president, before FCA put its bid to Renault, I've been told. He feels that, the people around John feel that they had the right chemistry to get this done. The timing seems to fit, the personalities seem to fit, they think they have deal magic here, one advisor tells me, and then boom, the French state asks for 5 days more, and John decides he cannot have French politics. The French state, which has a 15% stake in Renault and will have only a 7% stake in the merged company, calling the shots even before any deal is done. He considers, and people close to him consider, the market's going to judge this badly, this prevarication by the French state, and it's going to put his family investment at unnecessary risk. And so John Elkann walks away from the deal.
So Fiat Chrysler withdraws its proposal for Renault. And now everyone from reporters to people even inside these companies were trying to figure out what would happen next.
There was a great deal of confusion. There was certainly an effort to, back in Paris, there was certainly an effort to make it look as though it was Nissan's intransigence that had scuffed this whole thing. But then you really started getting the sense that the locus of blame lay with the French state, and that, you know, Nissan really didn't have much of a choice. It had to abstain. The reason it had to do that is because it couldn't have voted for without having more information. It didn't want to vote against because it actually could see some merits in this merger proposal. And the abstention it judged, maybe wrongly, you know, out of 20 votes, two abstentions were not going to kill the whole thing dead. But then, you know, as it turns out, that they were sort of made to make it feel like that was the case. So there was some consternation in Japan that, you know, certainly that, you know, maybe there'd been a miscommunication, or maybe, you know, there was a, I think there was a genuine chance, knowing both sides as you know, we do, there was a genuine chance that there had been serious miscommunication.
That maybe this wasn't quite the calculated move some had interpreted it to be.
But then you had this extraordinary tit-for-tat day or two later, where Senard, who has personally supported Nissan's attempts to get its corporate governance back on track after years of being pretty shoddy and pretty heavily criticized by analysts. And one of the main things that Nissan had decided to do, you know, based on recommendations from a committee that included people from Renault, or ex-people from Renault, was to install this three-committee system for the board. And that's sort of regarded as the kind of, the best way to ensure a measure of independence on things like remuneration and the selection of future executives and nominations for the next board. Two things that were obviously lacking at Nissan under Ghosn. You know, and that plan seemed very straightforward, actually. I mean, difficult to implement, but straightforward, sort of ethically and sort of intellectually straightforward.
And these new corporate governance proposals, well, Nissan is set to put them up for a vote at its annual shareholder meeting today, June 25th. I talked to Leo and David again late last week about what's been going on between Renault and Nissan since news of Fiat Chrysler's proposal first broke. That's why they're going to sound a little different than they have so far.
When they wanted to, Renault really hit Nissan where it hurt. And we discovered from our sources that just a couple of weeks ahead of that, Renault had sent a letter. Well, Jean-Dominique Senard had sent a letter to his to the Nissan CEO, Hirota Saikawa, saying, look, we're not going to vote for these changes. We're just going to abstain. And of course, Renault has a 43% stake in Nissan. And effectively, that abstention means that Nissan can't get those changes through, changes that are extremely important to Nissan's kind of self-image and to its, its attempt to convince shareholders that it's moving on from the Ghosn era. So that was a really serious blow. And it was very clear from the moment that we broke that story that what was happening was that Renault was providing the start to a negotiation, that it wanted something. And then within a few days, it emerged what it was that what it was they wanted was for Thierry Bolloré to have a seat on one of these committees.
Thierry Bolloré, the chief executive of Renault.
The understanding is that Nissan's going to give this to Renault. They're going to put Thierry Bolloré, Renault's CEO, on the audit committee. That looks like it's going to pave the way to a deal. They'll get the support at the AGM, and there is an element of, you know, peace accord, of playing nice now. The thing to keep in mind, though, is that Stenar, I think, wants to restart the relationship and thinks these boards might be able to do that. Somewhere in the back of his mind, I think, is a hope of bringing back this FCA deal in the medium term, in the next year. Again, this is just from sources, from talking to people. The idea is that if it goes longer than that, market conditions will have changed enough that kind of the deal that had been put in place will become stale, and it just won't be possible without an enormous amount of refounding. Again, from conversations with people in the French state, their opinion is we need to settle. We need to find an agreement with Nissan. That's the most important thing. And they think that that should be the priority, and their timeline is not set. So there is an urgency of sorts on the Renault side, with FCA in mind, and on the French state side, a willingness to wait as long as it takes, really, I think, to get that kind of stable, positive relationship with Nissan in place.
Rachel, how about Fiat? What is their thinking? What is John Elkann's thinking on where things stand?
The Agnelli dynasty held their annual family meeting last week in Turin. In total, there were about 100 members of the Agnelli family gathered at the historic base of Fiat in northern Italy to hear John Elkann talk about their investment. Inevitably, he ran through what had happened with the bid to merge with Renault. He explained the logic. He explained what went wrong, an unnecessary delay in his view by the French state. He pointed out that other investments have made great gains, but John's main message to the family, I've been told, was, and now it's time to get back to business as usual. Which, of course, it's not. It's very difficult to suddenly go back to business as usual after a bid proposal like that to Renault. Someone close to John said to me, this was a move that put the cat among the pigeons, meaning that it has shaken up Global Autos. It's put a firecracker into a sector that has already known, even though it's been running profits, but it already knows it needs to deal with these big issues we've spoken about. So the expectation widely held now is that this was just the first part of what will probably be a multi-part drama. And sooner or later, a deal will happen in the global auto industry. But the parts are still moving. The characters are still moving. We don't know where it will land. But we do know that John Elkann has shown he clearly wants to be part of it.
So more deal making is inevitable. I guess it's just a matter of who it will ultimately be with. Thank you, Rachel, David, and Leo. You can read more from these three, as well as the rest of our deals reporting team, at FT.com. If you like this episode or one of our earlier episodes, we'd really appreciate it if you could rate and leave a review of the show on Apple Podcasts. It is a really helpful way for people to find the show. You can also email us at behindthemoney@FT.com, and I'm on Twitter at Amy P. Keen. That's AimePKeane. We'll be back with a new episode in a couple of weeks.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.